This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, we're bidding farewell to an old year and welcoming in a new one because we are slaves to artificial constructs like calendars. But since this is a time for New Year's resolutions, we'll offer one up. Let's try to do less moral grandstanding in 2017. And to explain why that's bad, we're welcoming University of Michigan postdoctoral research fellow Justin Tosi to the show. Meanwhile, with all of the talk of an incoming administration, we sometimes forget that our politics are primarily shaped by figures who've actually been in town for quite a while. One in particular is our sometimes reluctant Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Not too long ago, Ryan was the de facto standard bearer of all conservative politics and philosophy, but there's been a lot of changes lately. What does his future look like? We're going to dig down into the Ryanology to try to find that out. Finally, the funny thing about unaccountable executive power is that once it's unleashed, it's pretty hard to stuff back in the box from which it came. And now, America's drone war capability, which got ramped up considerably under President Barack Obama's administration, will become Donald Trump's plaything. We will take a look at some lasting executive branch regrets that will surely not stress you out at all. I'm Jason Lincolns with Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Matt Fuller, and Jessica Schulberg. And here's what happened first.
And we're back. I'm Zach Carter, joined as always by...
Me, Jason Lincolns. I'm here. Hi.
And today we're going to do something a little bit different. We've got a distinguished academic, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan's philosophy department.
That means not distinguished.
Yeah. His name is Justin Tosi. Justin, say hi to the people.
Hi, everybody.
So Justin has just published an article in a very prestigious philosophy academic journal called the Journal of Philosophy and Public Affairs. And it's about something that perhaps I've been just living in Washington too long, but it seems pretty common. It's a phenomenon that Justin calls moral grandstanding. And I read his paper, and it really just sort of struck me as something that was an important description of at least one way in which people often behave. So, Justin, can you just give us a quick run-through about, you know, what this idea of moral grandstanding is?
Sure. I should also say I have a co-author, Brandon Warmke of Bowling Green State University. This is the product of equal work and all that. Okay, so now I can just talk about
ethical yeah. considerations have been made to all parties.
You're not grandstanding on your authorship
right,
here.
There we go. Okay, so moral grandstanding is sort of the use of moral talk for self-promotion. So it's people using moral conversation, making moral claims to present an impressive image of themselves to others.
So that sounds to me like something that happens all the time. That, like, the value of
we're probably guilty of it ourselves.
I do it. Or have done it.
Yeah.
Try not to.
I mean, but the idea being that, like, you get social rewards for being perceived as
being cool and good.
Yeah, as being a morally upright person. And it makes me think about, like, a lot of stuff that happened in the Democratic primary where, like, people from, like, the Hillary Clinton camp and the Sanders camp didn't really need to come up with reasons to, like, disagree on policy grounds, but did need to convince each other that they were morally superior to one another. And I feel like it's still going on in the era of Trump where Democrats aren't really sure what to do with themselves.
Right. Yes, yeah, yeah.
But, like, you know, other than this being just kind of annoying and, like, causing things to kind of be irritating on Twitter, like, how is this a problem?
The main problem that we focus on is we need to be able to talk to each other about morality, or right? We need to be able to talk about what justice requires, what the right thing to do is. And we think that moral grandstanding is a bad thing because it gets in the way of this important practice.
So how does it do that? If one person is just out there saying, look how good I am, can't you see how good I am? How does that interfere with the debate? Or the discourse, rather. Not necessarily debate, but the public discussion of ideas.
Yeah. So one thing that happens is because people are trying to impress other people, what ends up happening is they say things to stand out rather than to actually just make good points about what we ought to do, mm-hmm. right? So if your goal is to impress people, you don't impress people by just making careful, like,
reasoned
arguments.
Yeah.
You impress people with saying really extreme things, and, you know, starting memes, things like that. but that's not very productive for actually getting at the truth. It's very productive for getting people to talk about you. But
it feels like akin to sort of like a sort of like another form of epistemic closure, where you're sort of like pinning yourself off and just inviting people to conform to you or else go fuck off.
Yeah, good. So this is one other problem, is we think it contributes to group polarization, right? And of course, epistemic closure is part of that.
Right.
So if the stakes of a moral conversation are we want to impress people, right, then
someone
you have
has
to fit
to
in.
And someone has to lose.
Yeah,
someone
yes.
Has
you
to
need
get beaten.
You need an out-group, and yeah. You need to stand out, right? So you end up making more and more extreme claims and distancing yourself from this other group, and the other group can also play off of this distancing and set you up as sort of their boogeyman. And the result is you get very polarized groups. This is why America's currently a partisan hellscape.
I kind of felt like something like that was going on in the policy arena when we got to talking about the sort of contraception requirements of the healthcare law, where we had like actual practicing Catholics who couldn't get with certain parts of the contraception agreement, and it devolved into a situation where one side were just yelling at the other, and basically nuns were saying, we do good things for the world, and women were saying, you know, we don't want to have, you know, our rights taken from us because of beliefs we don't share with you. And there never became any kind of like really dialogue about what constituted a just solution for all parties in that situation. It was either one side gets to win or the other side gets to win. And there could have been a middle ground we could have reached in that, but we failed to
do
so.
It's almost sort of like an arms race, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So we say it's like a moral arms race, right? So it doesn't really impress people if you're good at compromising, if you're good at listening to the other side. It impresses people if you can destroy other people in arguments.
Yes, right? Yes. And this, I mean, there's a little bit of gender tied up in this, I think. You know, dudes got to, like, show that they're, like, the most masculine dudes ever by totally owning somebody on Twitter. But
right.
But women do this,
can
too.
Be. Yeah.
You know, I was sort of thinking about it. You end up with a situation. And Justin, correct me if I'm wrong here, because it's your paper. But it was just making me think that, like, it's sort of like a situation which you have, like I hate the marketplace of ideas as a metaphor, but I'm going to use it for practical purposes anyway.
Fair enough.
Where you sort of have, like, instead of, you have a thought policing situation, except instead of somebody directing the thought police, you have, like, this market failure in the marketplace of ideas where people are just going to ridiculous conclusions based on the way the sort of social rewards for moral behavior and moral perceptions are set up. Do you think that's like a reasonable way of thinking of it?
Yeah, that's interesting. So the thought is something like a normal market process, if we have a marketplace of ideas, would be just people deciding what seems right to them, right?
Right, and we discuss it and we figure out, oh, that's wrong. Okay, well, that's true, but this one's good.
Right,
and
arguing about it.
And the
reward, you know,
the reward
reasons.
Becomes finding that conclusion. Everyone benefits.
Right.
The positive sum
game
for everybody.
Yeah.
Instead, we have the zero sum kind of situation happening.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. I see it. So the goal isn't sort of an efficient exchange of ideas. It's who's the best producer?
Yeah. who's gonna get monopoly
cleanliness.
Control over moral righteousness?
Yeah, there's something to that.
You know, how much of this I want to maybe interrogate this argument a little bit because, like, I feel we're so focused on things like social media. But I've always – my biggest concern maybe with the sort of, like, rise of social media has been we, like, place the energy we would normally place in, like, actual activism and productive conversation, being in a room with people, working toward a goal, taking that goal onto the street and convincing people of its viability and justness. And swapped it for a situation where someone says something, we like, star, fave it, and it feels like that energy has been expunged, and then we assume that change has happened because we pressed a button somewhere. Is that part and parcel of what we're talking about here?
It's related, yeah. So this is called moral licensing, right? So people feel like they've done their part by doing something basically meaningless and ineffective.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so grandstanding tends to take those forms, or, you know, very, very often at least. Yes, yeah, social media is kind of a breeding ground for this sort of behavior.
I'm sure if we didn't have social media, well, maybe I'm wrong. If we didn't have social media, we'd just find another venue to flourish.
Yeah, people will always find a way to do this. This is not new.
But social media does, like everything, it makes this worse, too.
Yeah. bigger stage. Yeah.
Well, so what do you do about it? I mean, to be clear, you're making a distinction here. Moral grandstanding is not making a moral claim, right? There's a difference between talking about morality and grandstanding about
it. Yeah, so this is one unfortunate product of a lot of moral grandstanding is that people become cynical about morality, right? So they think it's all for show, right? It's all about showing people that your heart is in the right place rather than just about trying to get at what we ought to do. So this is unfortunate for a lot of reasons. So this is, you know, we talk to people about this paper and you know, one reply that we get a lot is, oh, well, you're just grandstanding about grandstanding, right? Which, I mean, that's possible, right? Wouldn't be a very effective, there'd be a lot shorter routes to getting recognition than this.
Exactly.
But, you know, that sort of makes our point in a way, right? So we're just making ordinary moral claims, or at least they could be, even if...
They can be interrogated, discussed, critiqued, whatever.
Yeah, right, but the response is this dismissive, oh, it's just, you know, another... This is just more of the same.
That does seem like a kind of nihilistic response.
Yeah.
if they're right, then there's just nothing to be done, right? We should just all yell at each other on Twitter forever. But so what do we do? We got to wrap this up pretty quickly. But what, you know, how should we combat moral grandstanding if indeed, you know, it seems like you see this as a problem.
Yeah, good. So what we really don't want people to do is to start calling each other out for grandstanding. So we worry, you know, first of all, you can't really be certain about what's motivating someone. I mean, sometimes it's pretty clear, to be honest, but
right.
you can't really know. And if you do call them out, the ensuing discussion is bound to be nasty and unhelpful. You're probably just going to be another occasion for more people to grandstand. So, you know, we don't want to encourage this to, you know, to be like the next mansplaining, right? So everything, a man explaining something is mansplaining now.
Right.
So what you should do, though, is I think... you can pretty safely just stop giving people credit for it, right? Stop liking grandstanding posts on social media. Stop voting for politicians because they come across as the good guy in publicity stunts. And we also think, you know, now that you've heard me talk about and us talk about how awful this is, try not to do it yourself, right? Hopefully some of its appeal is gone.
Maybe just have a nice dialogue with people who you feel like you can have an intellectually honest conversation with.
Yeah, including people you disagree with.
Right.
All right. Well, I think that's a pretty good New Year's resolution type of thing to say. I think that everyone, I don't know, me and Zach could probably benefit from some of this instruction. And so could everyone else. I think that probably just less social media in 2017 is a good idea all around for everybody.
Yeah. All right. Well, Justin Tosi, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Season's greetings. So, guys, obviously, one thing we have to look forward to in the new year is Donald Trump's inauguration. But there will be another significant figure of power. I know, we're all excited. In Republican circles, that's also going to be looking ahead at what could be a problematic, troublesome, or maybe happy new year. And that is our Speaker of the House, Wisconsin Representative Paul Ryan, who famously neutraled his way through the election season and now stands poised to do something. We're going to try to figure out what. Joining us right now, Arthur Delaney.
Hello.
And we're happy, I think, first time on the show.
First time.
Won't be the last.
But maybe the last.
Well, nothing is promised. Matt Fuller is here.
Hello.
Matt, you are quite a good Ryanologist.
Is a field of medicine that I don't know of.
But Matt Fuller is a top Capitol Hill correspondent for us, and he's deeply sourced with the Republicans.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, as in the post-election interregnum, as best as you know or can describe, where was Paul Ryan's thinking at?
Yeah, I think everyone knew that Ryan wasn't completely on board with the Trump train. He had sort of introduced quite a bit of daylight before the election happened. He did his whole month-long, you know, wavering, neutraled,
yeah,
as you said. He was critical throughout the campaign season and then sort of came around a little bit at the very end, I think, sensing that there was could be some blowback if Trump had lost, and then members were like, well, where were you, and why didn't he win Wisconsin? And, of course, the other alternate history happens, and Trump wins. So now Ryan, you know, has sort of gone the complete opposite way, where he was showing so much hesitancy. Now he's, you know, fully on board, and anything Trump does, you know, nothing is beyond the pale here. When he was asked, well, how should he handle his conflicts of interest, is, quote, however he wants to, right?
Right.
it's quite an amazing position.
He's been, hesitancy has been his brand for the past 2 years. Remember when he became Speaker in this Congress?
Yeah.
By saying, I'll only do it, but you'll have to drag me away from my family.
I have conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. And you must promise to let me go home and spend time with my family whenever I want.
Yeah. I don't know if that's holding up as well either. I mean, we interviewed him in June, and he had said essentially that he's spending one day a week, you know, with his kids. Saturday is still sort of like district political time, fundraising. Might slow down a little bit around the holidays, get some deer hunting in or whatever.
Right.
Grows a beard and stuff. But yeah, I think it's still, this is a very demanding job, and he's realized that. There's been a lot of the expectations that Ryan had, and then now him coming to terms with the reality of it, which is this is not easy, and the magic of Paul Ryan doesn't extend to the speakership, and people don't really care that he's Paul Ryan, and you know, oh, I want a budget done, and it's like, well, no, we want, you know, we want the budget number at the number we want it, and oh, well, we're going to pass all the appropriations bills. Well, no, you're going to pass 5 appropriations bills, which is actually worse than what Boehner was able to do.
Not, yeah, there was no regular order. They right. We flunked that spectacularly.
Total F. I mean, they actually did, I guess, get one bill into law, which the MILCON VA, Military Construction and the Veterans Affairs appropriations bill. But that is, the, you know, perennially the easiest lift of them all. And we ended the year with another continuing resolution. We've kicked it off into April.
I can't get past the fact that in the spring, when he had won some primaries, and Paul Ryan hadn't endorsed him yet, Donald Trump threatened him.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Even we're in August, and Trump was threatening him. He was saying with Paul Nealon, which was Ryan's primary opponent.
Yeah,
he was saying, you know, he was flirting with backing the guy who's clearly a huge Trumpkin himself.
Okay, so what does it say about? Does it say anything? Because I am clearly obsessed with it. What does it say about a man that he endorses someone who threatens him?
Yeah, well, I think we're watching the slow, you know, the unmasking of Paul Ryan and the whole I'm a serious, principled, conservative person. We're learning with a lot of Republicans that, you know, these principles that they had, these moral convictions that they, you know, would stand up and I'm not going to do this or I'm going to do that. We're learning it's kind of bullshit, right?
I mean, I have to say it's been like a dizzying ride following Paul Ryan's career, because it was not so long ago, like literally not long ago, that Paul Ryan was essentially considered the heart of the conservative movement. you know, indistinguishable and indivisible from conservatism itself. The guy who was the famed policy wonk who dressed up all the numbers, was on Sunday morning television all the time, speaking on behalf of the party. And in such a short time, he's become almost like an outsider. But he's still striving. I mean, yeah. During the – another thing he was doing during the election was – trying to fill what he probably assumed correctly would be a big policy vacuum. Yeah.
Well, I think so. First of all, Democrats and Republicans both want to believe in the myth of Paul Ryan, that there's this conservative, smart, wonk guy who doesn't just hate, you know, he doesn't hate poor people. He just believes in something different. And, you know, they want to believe that a guy who knows actuarial tables is out there poring over data and coming up with conservative plans. So it's sort of reassuring. But the thing with Trump, I mean, Trump is really the anti-Paul Ryan, right?
Oh,
I mean, anti-immigration, Paul Ryan's pro-immigration, anti-trade. Paul Ryan was the biggest cheerleader of trade in the House of Representatives. Anti-cronyism, right? We're now seeing with the carrier deal. And we get another instance where Ryan just sort of rolls over with this carrier deal. You know, he was – you've probably heard him say winners and losers, Paul Ryan, the last 5 years or so.
Oh, yeah.
The government should not choose them.
We shouldn't be picking winners and losers.
yeah.
So, and yet, you know, he's asked about the carrier deal. And he says, well, a lot of people are going to get their keep their jobs. So, you know, how about that? So it's really the flexibility of Ryan is what we're witnessing. And it's an interesting look. But at the same time, there is at least some element of defense to this, I think, right? He's sort of saying, well, you want someone to be there during the really dire situation. You need someone who's in the room who has some sort of credibility with Trump, who can stand up to him.
Who will serve as a potential check on Trump's potential authoritarianism?
I mean, and there's an argument to be made that we went way past that check a long time ago, and Ryan should have spoken up then and didn't. Or, you know, you could also say he did, because there was a few times where he spoke out against, you know, the Muslim ban is, I guess, the most famous one. But when Trump was slow to denounce David Duke and the KKK, and there are a whole slew of instances where Ryan did speak out. But now he seems resigned to the fact that he has to be a Trump cheerleader. And the thing that about this is maybe if he cheers loud enough, maybe he gets like a Medicare overhaul, yeah. Which is what, you know, his ultimate goal in Congress has always been.
I've tried to put myself in Paul Ryan's shoes since the election, just to try to contemplate where his thinking's at. And part of me is not surprised to hear him go so soft on conflicts of interest. I mean, we know that if Hillary Clinton had won the election, he'd be like asking for the Clinton Foundation to be torn down root and branch. But like, I can see a potential calculus Paul Ryan where he knows that what he's got is a guy who's is most dangerous when he's angry and impulsive. And it could be that you trade the conflicts of interest and self-enrichment just as, you know, ensuring that Donald Trump gets some kind of reward out of all of this.
Yeah.
You know, to keep him quiet, happy, and less likely to start pushing the wrong kind of buttons.
And that's the most charitable take. And I don't think it's necessarily wrong. It's just at some level, this is a question of where you draw that line. And we've seen continually Paul Ryan push off that line. And I think we're all wondering, you know, when is that moment where, you know, the come to Jesus moment for Paul Ryan and Donald Trump? And there, you know, everyone has sort of assumed there will be a reckoning at some point, because no one really thinks that this friendship or whatever we want to call it is going to last. Paul Ryan just seems to think he can play Trump, right? That if he smiles and talks about how great he is and we're going to make America great again, then Trump will just sort of forget about all the little grudges he's had. But
that does appear to be working, because Donald Trump said early in December that Paul Ryan is like a fine wine.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I, this is the one thing I'll say. I don't think Trump is a smart person, okay? But he does seem to hold a long grudge, and he does seem to understand there is sort of the difference between, to borrow Hillary's thinking, a public position and a private one.
Yeah.
I still don't think that privately Donald Trump is on board with Paul Ryan. I think Paul Ryan believes he is. I know that they're talking constantly. I think it was said that they talk every day, which is a significant amount of interaction with
someone. There was this notion that Paul Ryan is teaching Donald Trump about the Constitution.
Yeah, and well, look, there's also the people who are surrounding Trump, right? You have Ryan Priebus, who's a great Ryan ally. You have Mike Pence, same thing. I think people assume Jared Kushner. I think you call this the axis of establishment, which is a pretty good way to describe it.
Yeah.
And Ryan, I think, is taking comfort in the fact that the people who are surrounding him are his allies. And there's obviously the one person who's not, who's has Trump's ears, Steve Bannon.
Who hates Paul Ryan.
Absolutely hates Paul Ryan. Right. And and has made no qualms about that. And we've seen private emails where he's, you know, he's rubbing his social Catholicism in my face. And
he does like to do that.
Yeah. And well, they ran stories about Paul Ryan's kids going to attending a private Catholic school, that he has a border wall around his house. I mean, Breitbart has been an enthusiastic opponent of Paul Ryan's, and that's not lost on Paul Ryan at all. It's just amazing to see when Bannon was appointed and the opportunity to denounce Bannon essentially, or at least voice some hesitancy. Ryan's response was, I'm looking forwards, not looking backwards.
He responds does he just want to be president?
You know,
in 4 to 8 years,
everyone has assumed that that was Paul Ryan's game plan here. Where, okay, Trump, you put a sort of a close that chapter, and we move ahead, and Paul Ryan sort of takes the party into a new direction, and can kind of say, and actually, I think we were all expecting it. In fact, this is well known. But we've written a story on it too, but. There was supposed to be the sort of November 9th reckoning, because everyone assumed, including Paul Ryan, that Hillary would win. And then Trump would whine and say, actually, I did win, and millions of voters, and legally, and whatever. Right. And Paul Ryan might come in and say, you know what, that chapter's over. I think it's time to move on. Hillary is our president. And he could do that. And, of course, that didn't pan out, right? So Ryan is just thinking, let's move ahead and not – well, I guess that reality doesn't exist anymore, and that's that.
Well, man. Speaker of the House, man. I tell you, the real winner here is John Boehner. The sommelier's tongue knew when he was drinking from a poison chalice.
Merlot, yeah.
Oh, let's have a little John Boehner.
Oh, the American people love Paul Ryan. They're asking, where are the jobs? Where are the jobs? Obama needs to get off his ass. Yeah.
It's like I'm in the room with him.
Give me a camel.
John Boehner. All right. Thanks, Matt, for joining us. And we will be right back. Hey, everybody. I just want to take the time to thank all of you for listening to this podcast. And I wanted to let you know that you can help us grow this podcast and grow the audience that you're a part of. Just go to iTunes and subscribe to So That Happened and leave a rating while you're there to let us know how we're doing. Doing so will help other people find us and allow this audience to grow and this podcast to flourish and become even better. So thanks very much for helping us out and for always being here for us. Hey, we're back, and got Arthur Delaney by my side.
Hello.
And we're also joined by one of our favorite people, Jessica Schulberg.
Hello.
Huffington Post foreign policy reporter. And we're going to talk about what I have to imagine is one of your favorite topics, the unaccountable drone program.
That is one of my favorites.
So President Obama, he droned some folks. And he has, I think, expanded the reach of his executive power when it comes to the drone program. And now, he's about to hand all of this over to who is it again?
Donald Trump.
That's the guy. Donald Trump. He's going to be the next president. He was a former reality television star and
casino
impulsive
mogul.
Casino mogul. Yes, mogul. I mean, mogul in the fact that you can hit a mogul and go flying over your skis and wipe out.
Also a
mogul.
Twitter star.
And a Twitter star, impulsive. Kind of guy fires
and now
off
he's
a lot
got
of
lots of hellfire missiles.
And now he's got hellfire missiles. So, here's what I recall: 4 years ago, when it was actually hilarious because I believe this happened after the first debate, where Obama went up against Romney and Romney kind of pasted him, and for a second the poll shifted and looked like Romney might prevail. And the Obama administration, who in a move that I thought at the time was like way too clever by half, started sort of like tinkering around with the idea of sort of restricting the drone program in the idea that, oh, fall into Romney's hands. Now, Mitt Romney may have had a lot of faults, but one of them was not the fact that he evince the sort of like taste for blood.
Right. He wasn't going to impulsively drown people any more impulsively than Obama would have.
This is a guy who probably would have taken his cues from some spreadsheet. He was a technocrat. Trump, not the same kind of person. So has there been a revival of concern over whether they've let this sort of like Bush era executive power cat too far out of the bag?
Well, a couple of things. A, to even call it Bush era, I think is a little bit unfair to George W. because the Obama administration has dramatically expanded the use of drones, both in the frequency in which they use them, the number of countries that are using them, and even the description of what the White House uses to establish what's a legitimate target. It can be more of a, you know, this guy fits the profile in terms of, you know, certain age male in an area known to be occupied by militants. It's not necessarily like we know for certain it is this specific person that we're targeting.
Right.
The second thing is about the level of panic within the White House. Yes, I'd imagine there's a fair amount. But what's important to remember is that when the New York Times broke the story that the Obama administration was briefly tinkering with the idea of actually writing some rules around the drone program, that report came out mid-2013, so well after the actual tinkering would have occurred.
Right.
So I do think that we'll probably have more luck getting leaks from this next year through Freedom of Information requests, through disgruntled Obama administration staffers. But so far, what has come out is that the Obama administration is not making any sweeping changes to the program. What we've seen instead is the Obama administration releasing somewhat more publicly the legal rationale that his administration has used to execute the drone program. He released in early December, a 61-page report, which is sort of like the comprehensive legal explanation as to not just the drone program, his almost his entire counterterrorism program, including detention policy, drones, airstrikes against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And I don't know that definitely wasn't reining Trump in. That was more trying to show an increasing level of transparency. But even in this report, you know, a lot is left up to the executive, and a lot does happen behind closed doors.
Help us understand the scale of Obama's drone wars. For instance, Iraq war killed thousands of Americans and, what, a million people in Iraq. And how many people are we droning? I had heard that it was low thousands.
Are you talking about militants or civilians?
Either one.
Yeah, the whole
deal. Just give us a little bit of how many people were droning.
Well, so we're looking at people in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Pakistan, at least, just within the Obama administration's presidency. And it is in the thousands. This isn't, you know, some mass scale, you know, tens of thousands of people being wiped off the planet. But what's hard, too, is, I mean, the numbers vary depending on who you ask. The I'm going to butcher the name, but the Investigative Bureau for Investigative Journalism, they track the drone strikes probably most closely, and their data on civilian strikes are quite a bit higher than what the Obama administration's released.
Well, no, go figure.
And part of that, again, could be, you know, how do we count a civilian?
Well, yeah, one of the fun little tricks of language that we hear in the drone program is that they have this concept called the signature strike,
right,
which makes it sound like you're getting like a special concierge level drone attack.
Quite
like at a hotel,
opposite.
You get like, yeah, it's like literally the signature strike is actually a more vague attack than the, I forget what the alternative is. You've gotten a sense now of kind of the way Donald Trump's cabinet is shaping up, and how don't laugh, don't
Do you
laugh.
Want me to cry?
Don't laugh or cry, and like how his specifically his NATSEC and defense cabinet is shaping up in terms of who. Forget that we're handing this over to Trump. We're also obviously handing the program over to a group of advisors that will be sort of endeavoring to explain to him, hopefully, the most prudent use of all aspects of our military force. What kind of confidence do you have in Trump's NATSEC crew when it comes to the drone program?
Well, let's start
with the stipulation that we won't get a full picture of who those people are until after the first of the year.
We do have a defense secretary, head of the CIA, and the national security advisor, which is honestly kind of the big three. Secretary of State will be important, but not the one who's making the final calls here. So let's go from good to bad, I guess. So okay. If we look at the Pentagon, we've got General James Mattis heading the military, who's widely respected, thought to be almost like a military scholar, very well-read, very thoughtful.
And in the Marine community, revered.
Exactly. Yeah. Definitely more hawkish instincts than what I think some progressives would hope for, but not in an irrational, impulsive way. So I think military is in good hands, relatively, if we look there.
Now, a weird thing about him is he's not long enough out of the military for our rules for civilian leadership. So right. He's going to get an exemption from Congress.
Right. So in order to prevent the military from having an excessive amount of control and potentially staging a coup, we used to have a 10-year, you used to have to be out of the military for 10 years before you could become defense secretary. Several years ago, Congress shortened that to 7 years. However, James Mattis has only been out for 3 years, which makes him pretty far away. Democrats seemed like they were sort of toying with the idea of not granting him this special waiver that he would need to head the military. I think even within the congressional Democrats, there was some thinking like, is this really the hill we want to die on? And then the Republicans sort of forced the waiver to get attached to a giant must-pass spending bill. So Mattis will get his waiver.
But you don't figure him for a serial violator of posse comitatus.
Don't figure him where we need to be most worried. So if we move over to the CIA, which has also had, the drone program was split between JSOC, which is under the Pentagon, and the CIA, depending on which country we're operating in.
JSOC is the Joint Special Operations Command.
Yeah. Committee? Command.
Right. They figure heavily in books like Dirty Wars.
Right.
Right.
All the secret special ops guys. But over at the CIA, that's headed by Congressman Mike Pompeo, who publicly seems kind of like an asshole, to be honest. I mean, he speaks very highly of the Enhanced Interrogation Program, which is what we call torturing people.
Yeah, which so does Trump.
Exactly. Loves He's much more in line with Trump, came out in support of Trump very early, kind of made the Iran nuclear deal like his number one issue during his time in Congress, pulled a bunch of stunts like going to the equivalent of the Iranian embassy in the U.S., which is more of like a little office building, and demanded a visa to go to Iran and observe, the human rights situation there and monitor their elections, which is, kind of just a big political ploy. What I have heard from folks over in the intelligence community is that in private closed briefings, Pompeo is on the House Intelligence Committee, and everyone says that in private he's actually much more thoughtful and serious, and that as a legislator, he's been a bit of a political hack, but people at the CIA are actually pretty confident that once he moves over to the agency, he'll be a little bit more apolitical and that he actually seems to take great interest in deliberating matters.
That's good. Okay. Who's behind door number three?
Door number three is where
this is where the tiger jumps out and mauls your face clean
that
off.
That would be, you're wearing like a tigery shirt. It's got black and orange stripes on it.
Nobody can see the shirt.
Yeah. That's why I'm describing it to everybody.
It's okay. Adorable.
Anyways, door number three, we've got Lieutenant General Mike Flynn. Used to be quite well respected. He was the head of the kind of the military CIA. It's called the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency.
And then he became like a walking caricature from Dr. Strangelove.
He gets pushed out, and ever since then, he's taken to just saying absolutely batshit crazy things on Twitter.
He's a Pizzagate guy.
He is a big pusher of Pizzagate. He routinely.
Well, I thought it was his son, not
both.
Him too. His son has recently been retweeting Mike Cernovich, that guy that thinks that rape is fake because the women want it.
Yeah.
Son retweets him all the time. Mike Flynn has retweeted some Pizzagate things before the armed gunman came in to come at Pizzeria and shot the floor.
Yeah.
Mike Flynn was running around throughout the campaign yelling, lock her up, referring to Hillary Clinton, of course. People I've spoken with recently at the DIA said that even while he was there, he was known to say some pretty bad things about Muslims, said that they're another breed during an award ceremony with an Australian counterpart.
And if I recall correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, because I know there's a sort of high prevalence of this kind of weird idea among some of Trump's coterie, but isn't Flynn one of those people that like expressly believes that Iran and ISIS are completely in cahoots with each other?
He just thinks radical Islam is bad. They're all against us. They're all working together. They're all one and the same, which sort of overlooks these big glaring issues where the Iranians are fighting ISIS and there's this huge Shia Sunni chasm within the Muslim world.
So President Obama is maybe he didn't talk about reining in his drones, but he certainly did at the beginning of December say, man, Congress really ought to start declaring wars instead of letting presidents do it. which was a bit rich considering
so
you know,
rich.
He had had kind of. White House lawyers twist all yeah. logic mm-hmm. into saying that the 2001 authorization serves all their purposes. Yeah.
And even when in this last speech he gave, he said, you know, Congress, like I came to you guys 2 years ago and I asked for another war authorization and you guys punted because you didn't want to take a difficult vote. That's all true, but he came to Congress after he already started bombing ISIS in Iraq and Syria and made it very clear that him asking Congress to weigh in on this, whether or not he should be doing it, was purely symbolic and he was going to do it no matter what. So it is a bit rich of him to blame Congress for the current predicament we have.
And, it is a current and ongoing predicament.
One thing I would add, I know we're running out of time, but just when we're talking about, you know, magic door number three, Mike Flynn, his title is National Security Advisor, which maybe sounds less important than being the head of a major agency like the military or the CIA. But in recent history, and especially under the Obama administration, the National Security Advisor has had arguably one of the most important roles in government. I mean, he has the direct ear of the president. He's often the last person that the president will hear on any big issue. And we know that with Donald Trump, he tends to be most influenced by the last person he talks to. So it's quite troubling to think that guy could be Mike Flynn.
Prepare for Pizzagate diplomacy.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, sounds great as normal. All right. Thank you, Jessica, for once again coming on and talking us through the coming eschaton. Arthur, eschaton. Thanks for being here too. We will be right back.
Eschaton.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by University of Michigan postdoctoral research fellow Justin Tosi, as well as Huffington Post reporters Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, Matt Fuller, and Jessica Schulberg. So That Happened is available on iTunes. You can go to iTunes.com/So That Happened and check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, please subscribe. Tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, please send an email to SoThatHappened@HuffingtonPost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening, and Happy New Year.